This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Ray Davies, no relation, the lead singer and songwriter for the band The Kinks. To celebrate The Kinks' 50th anniversary, there's a new box set collecting their recordings from 1964 to 71. It includes their hits All Day and All of the Night, Tired of Waiting for You, A Well-Respected Man, Sunny Afternoon, Lola, and I'm Not Like Everybody Else. The box set also includes lesser-known songs, as well as outtakes, demos, and remixes. The Kinks first came to the U.S. in 1965 and were considered part of the British invasion. They're now seen as one of the forerunners of punk rock, although the Kinks had too many sounds and styles to comfortably fit in any one category. They drew on rock and roll, folk, blues, British musical, and theater music. Let's start with their first hit. From 1964, this is You Really Got Me.
Ray Davies, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's great to have you on the show. And as I was telling you before we started, I've been a Kinks fan like since I was 12, but I've never sat down and listened to album after album after album the way I did with this new 5-CD anthology. And what an extraordinary volume of work. And that only takes us to like 1971, the new album. So, wow, is all I can say. So, let me ask you about You Really Got Me. Is that how you heard the song in your mind when you wrote it?
Well, You Really Got Me is a strange one because I went to art school. I was doing a 5-year degree course as a painter, a sculptor, and filmmaker. And music was my hobby. But at college, we had lots of great bands playing, and it was early days of R&B in Great Britain. I wanted to be a sideman, basically, just play along with other people because I hadn't really written songs. I was more interested in painting. But I played in a few bands. The great Lowell Coxhill, who not many people in America know, but he was kind of a legendary mentor and inspiration for a load of musicians in the UK. Lowell was an improvisational jazz guy, and I was an upstart R&B player. And we sat down jamming one night. It was to a song called Doo-Doo Ron Ron by the Crystals. And he looked at me and he said, you know, you should do this R&B music and write your own songs, because he felt that I could write riffs. And I went home and I was trying to write country blues. I was very influenced by a lot of American music. And it's a mixture of a Gregorian chant, because I sang in the choir at school. And if you think of it as, girl, you really got me going. So it's that, to a big Bill Brunsey phrase, you know, which is basically G7. So it evolves through a mixture of blues and my sort of English quirky subliminal influence of being in a choir doing Gregorian chant, which definitely comes through if you really think about it.
Wow, I never would have thought that You Really Got Me Going was inspired by Gregorian chant. That never, ever would have occurred to me.
I was 16, 17 at the time, and I was, you know, experimented at that age, and then the riff came to me, and I played it as a sort of a country riff to begin with, and I thought it'd be good just to have power chords. I also then went to the piano to write the rest of the song, and the piano changed the dynamic a little bit.
What's some of the music that you grew up with? You had, what, 8 siblings? I think your father played banjo. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I had 6 sisters, and much older than I. The youngest, nearest in age to me is Gwen, and Gwen is, I think, 7 years older than I am. So there's a generation gap almost between my brother and our sisters. And they, of course, we were exposed to music of their era, big band music, a lot of jazz, a lot of 50s, bebop, and early rock and roll that we wouldn't have been had found accessible to us without them. And they were incredible dancers. They used to go dancing. The dance hall was called the Palais. And I wrote a musical about 7 years ago called Come Dancing about my sisters. And it was we actually made a record called Come Dancing as well. So they're very big influence. And we used to watch them dance with their boyfriends, look through the keyhole and when we shouldn't be looking. They're a vital part of our musical education. Dad was into Dixieland. In many respects, he was sort of an early blues man in many ways. He moved brilliantly. The dance hall style of dancing, as you probably know or heard about, was very rigid and formulaic. But Dad's dancing was very loose, almost like it was from Louisiana or somewhere. And so it was an oddball family. And we always had a sing-song every weekend. My parents encouraged the girls to bring back their boyfriends and play records and play the piano. All my sisters played the piano. We had piano lessons.
So another track I want to play that's included on the new anthology, and it's Dead End Street. And this is a good example of just kind of like working class reality songs about, you know, like this song is about people in a dead end street, about people who have no chance to emigrate and who are stuck. Does this relate to the neighborhood you grew up in at all?
Dead End Street came about. It had this massive hit called Sunny Afternoon. And everyone said, oh, it's great. England just won the World Soccer Cup. At the same time, Sunny Afternoon was a hit. And everything seemed centered. But I didn't feel that. I'm not morbid, but I'm a realist to the extreme sometimes. It was inspired by a leak in a pipe I had. Winter was coming on. And I realised all was not good in swinging London. It was a time when we devalued our currency. We had terrible immigration issues and culture was changing in England because England went through a tremendous, like so many places did after the Second World War, of austerity. And the 60s were meant to be the revival, the joy. But I was not of that belief. I think the 60s were in many respects a diversion, swinging London and all that. So I wanted to write a follow-up to Sunny Afternoon, which was a celebration really of the time. And Dead End Street, I think it came out in 67 or 66. It was almost written like a Dixieland stomp about hard times and depression, financial depression. And all is not well, but we are strictly second class and we don't understand. Because in the 60s, and the revolution that occurred with working class culture prior to that, everyone seemed to be classless. But for some reason, I instinctively knew, that it was not, strictly speaking, that way. So how do you make a pop song out of that? We managed to do it. We had an up chorus and some interesting chord changes. And I think it exemplified a period in England where people were thinking, hang on a minute, what's really happening here?
So this is Dead End Street, 1966, The Kinks, and it's included on the new 5-volume Kinks anthology.
Apartment on the second floor, no money coming in, the rent collector's not trying to get
That's the Kinks, recorded in 1966, Dead End Street. It's included on the new anthology, The Kinks, the anthology, 1964 to 1971. It's a 5-album set. And my guest is Ray Davies, the lead songwriter and singer of The Kinks, who, of course, also records solo albums. So I have to say that really sounds great, and it sounds really raw, too. I love how all the backup vocals are really just like shouting in the background.
The interesting thing about the record, though, is that the ending needed I wanted something other than a guitar solo. I wanted to be in the tradition of trad jazz. And we went, there was a pub, it was recorded at Pye Studios, which is in London, the centre of London. We went to the local pub and saw a musician who'd just been on a session who played trombone. And we dragged him in, just asked him to come and sit and play on it. We just grabbed him from a bar, put the solo on the end, and we mixed the record that night. So it's all chance. But I love things like that when they happen.
You were hospitalized as a child and ended up having to have an emergency tracheotomy when you were 7, I think it was. Is that right?
No, let's back up a bit.
Yes, let's.
I had an accident when I fell off a wall. Like, I was trying to fly, but I didn't realize the wall was like 12 feet high. And I fell and broke my jaw and busted my nose and lost lots of teeth when I was about 5 or 6. And I had to have a restorative operation just to re-engage my bite, and my jaw didn't set properly. So they put me in hospital. I had a tracheotomy because of my breathing, and I had a near-death experience because of a bad tracheotomy.
What do you remember from the near-death experience?
Oh, do you really want need to know that?
I don't need to know that, but if you wanted to share it, I'd be interested in knowing it.
I think it's I seem to remember lots of colors. It's partially because I was suffocating, you know, and I was sinking down, and had there were two horses with no flesh, just muscle and bone, colliding. I remember lots of colors as they merged into one another. That's the only way I can describe it. Then I felt terrible pressure on my chest, and the doctor was banging my chest. So I think everybody experiences these things in different ways. That was my recollection of what happened to me. I was very lucky. And ironically, the hospital was called St. Thomas's, and it was right by Waterloo Bridge. And Waterloo has played a very important part in my life. It's a district in London where they have a big train station. It's in the middle of London, near the Houses of Parliament. It's a beautiful, beautiful spot. You know, when you romanticise it, it's a wonderful place to be, seeing people going in different directions. Then I had the experience in the hospital when I was being operated on. And then I wrote a song years later called Waterloo Sunset. I think most people have this in their lives. To me, it's a blessed spot, you know, a moment that is a truthful spot where I can get centered. And it's by the River Thames. It's near Waterloo.
So in the song, the character is basically gazing out the window, looking at other people, looking at the sunset. Was that inspired by when you were in the hospital and you had to look out the window and you couldn't go out?
Well, that's the way I think a lot of writers work, particularly me as a songwriter. The experience I had at the hospital was probably almost 10 years before I wrote Waterloo Sunset. But I remember the moment of looking at, they wheeled me to the window with my stuff I was plugged into and stood me on the balcony. It's a beautiful balcony at the hospital, looks over the river. And probably I drew on that experience and put it in the song Waterloo Sunset, which is about a man watching two people, a young couple, walking across the bridge to their future. And the couple, to me, represented my sisters, who, amazingly, they enjoyed their life. They lived through the Second World War. They remembered the blackouts and the bombs and having to hide in shelters in the back garden, going in the subway when there were bombing raids in London. But yet they loved it, and they wouldn't have exchanged that time. Amazingly, wouldn't have exchanged that for any other reason. So the two characters in Waterloo Sunset were that generation going to the future. And I was a person observing from this window. And probably I thought of that experience years earlier when I stood at the window in the hospital. But that's the way I think a lot of writers work. You know, I've got a saying, my subconscious is smarter than I am. I write, I've drawn many emotions and memories from my past and the present. And sometimes, as in Waterloo Sunset, it's about the future. So all elements are there. And that's, I think, the magical thing you can do with song.
Well, let's hear Waterloo Sunset. This is the Kinks, and this track is included on the new Kinks anthology. Waterloo Sunset, written by my guest, Ray Davies, who also sings lead on that. It's included on the new Kinks anthology, which covers the years 1964 to 1971. You know, we were talking about how you were in the hospital when you were, how old, seven?
Older? No, I had the accident when I was six, between six and seven. Okay. They did the operation when I was 13, 14.
Oh, I see.
It's a repair job.
So that year that you had the accident and you were hospitalized, I think that was the same year that one of your older sisters died of a heart condition.
She died on my 13th birthday, so it's around that time, yeah.
Did that whole, you know, confluence of things, you being really sick and nearly dying and then your sister actually dying, make you feel very vulnerable or make you afraid of or at least reflective about death?
When you're 13 years old, it's my birthday. She gave me my first guitar on my birthday. As a present, we played. It was quite a surreal scene, almost. It was a sunny day. I was born Midsummer Day, so 21st of June. And she was told she had severe heart problems, but she loved to dance. And the doctors told her if she walked down the road, she'd probably have a heart attack. So she bought me this not very expensive Spanish guitar. Gave it to me on my birthday, and we played a few songs. She played a song on the piano, and I tried to play with her, and she said she was going out now. And I watched my sister go out. It was a sunny afternoon, and she walked down the road, and my mother stood at the gate, and that was it. And the next morning we got a call from the police that she had died dancing at a ballroom in London in the arms of a stranger. And they came to break the news to my parents. So it was, well, the birthday was forgotten, but that's irrelevant. But it was the whole sequence of events, her coming back from Canada where she'd emigrated to die, really. And again, being a source of inspiration, she was an artist herself, and seeing her go that way and the impact it had on the family. So I think anyone, teenager, experiences that situation has emotions attached to it. But I didn't realise what a watershed it was. She gave me my first guitar, which was quite a great parting gift. And on the piano she played the day she died, I wrote most of my early hits in that same room. It's the front room. The front room is where we had the parties. It's where the girls brought their boyfriends home and their husbands. It's where I was born in that room. My brother was born in that room, because in our, from our generation, people were born at home more. And my sister's parting gift was given to me in that room. So it's all very symbolic,
right,
which I think is quite beautiful, really.
So a Kink song that a lot of people have been hearing lately is I'm Not Like Everybody Else, because it's used on an Acura commercial, on a TV commercial. And I'm wondering,
really?
Oh, you don't know?
I have no idea. Well, that's great. If it, you know, the great thing about it, if it brings music to a new audience, it's fine. I love that song, and I still do it in my show.
Oh, I love that song too. And you wrote it.
I'm proud to have written. Sometimes I don't write the songs write me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was written, curiously enough, it was written for my brother to sing. And it's a song about being angry, and I cast the song for him. I do that sometimes. I've said this before, this analogy. Mick Jagger, to his credit, is always, you know what you're getting, he's jumping Jack Flash all the time, and he's a wonderful character. With me and my impact it has on the Kinks, I'm a different character sometimes when I sing songs. The man who sings All Day and All the Night, is it really the person who sings Waterloo Sunset and Days? So, but with I'm Not Like Everybody Else, I noticed a rebellious streak in my brother that was beyond my own, let's put it politely. And I wrote a song about anger for him to sing. And he sings, I think, on the original Kinks recording.
So here's I'm Not Like Everybody Else, recorded in 1966. It's from the soon-to-be-released box set The Kinks, the Anthology, 1964 to 1971.
I won't take all that they hand me down. They count, I smile, though I will frown. And I'm not gonna take it all lying down. Cause once I get started, I go to town. Cause I'm not like everybody else. I'm not like everybody else. I'm not like everybody else.
I'm Not Like Everybody Else is included on the new box set The Kinks, the Anthology, 1964 to 1971. You'll find a longer version of Terry's conversation with Ray Davies online at freshair.npr.org. If you're looking for books for a jazz fan on your holiday list, our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a few suggestions. Here's his review of three jazz books out this holiday season: a singer's biography, a pianist's autobiography, and a fat coffee table book. Kevin says they're all worth a look, though he has a couple of quibbles and also a confession.
The very thought of you, and I forget to do those little ordinary things that everyone ought to do.
This thing used to happen to Sheila Jordan. Some jazz journalists would interview her about her fascinating life, and the writer would say, "We should do a book together," and she'd say, "Great," and then nothing would happen. I know, because I was one of those useless writers. So I was pleased and relieved to get Ellen Johnson's book Jazz Child, a portrait of Sheila Jordan, much of it in the singer's own words.
Born in Detroit, Michigan, November the 18th, 1928, Mickey Mouse's birthday. My mother, she was only 16 years old, and she couldn't raise me. So she sent me to live with my grandparents in a small coal mining town in Pennsylvania State.
In western PA, she heard Grandpa's Cherokee chants and miners singing on the weekends before discovering bebop as a Detroit teenager. Her idol Charlie Parker befriended her. She moved to New York and recorded for Blue Note before dropping out to raise a daughter. When Sheila Jordan was in her late 50s, she began a steamrolling comeback and a second career as an inspiring teacher. 30 years on, she's still going.
I should have never left you. My life is incomplete.
Much as I enjoyed Ellen Johnson's Jazz Child, it isn't always the best organized or fact-checked jazz bio. But if I wanted it written to my specifications, I should have done it myself. Another good but flawed book out now is the dictionary-sized Blue Note Records Uncompromising Expression, celebrating the label's 75th anniversary. It's mostly an excuse to reproduce a lot of beautiful LP covers from the 50s and 60s, outtakes from album cover photo shoots, and session photographs by label partner Frank Wolfe. Richard Havers' text is good on Blue Note's early history and design sense, foggier on the 60s and awful on the 80s. He doesn't even tell us how Lee Morgan's 60s hit The Sidewinder kicked off a Blue Note trend, starting LPs with similar radio-friendly boogaloos. As a tie-in, Blue Notes issued a mini-box of 75 singles, also called Uncompromising Expression. The book is for the fans, but the box is an introduction, heavy on usual suspects like Jimmy Smith and Horace Silver. It has some of the book's flaws, slighting the 80s and touting the label's current pop-inflected stuff. It ends with five recent cuts, none released as singles, by the way, all unlikely to make Blue Note's next anniversary set. This one will still be there, though. Herbie Hancock's Watermelon Man. When he recorded that in 1962, Herbie Hancock said Watermelon Man was based on the cry of a Chicago street vendor. In his new autobiography, he revises that story. It's actually based on how the neighborhood ladies greeted the vendor as he rolled up the block. Hey, Watermelon Man. Herbie Hancock's book, Possibilities, written with Lisa Dickey, is full of such clarifying tidbits. By his own account, the pianist is cool and analytical, and he's good at dissecting his own behavior. He tells good stories about being mentored in the business by Donald Byrd and in music by Miles Davis, and talks about his love of technology and how it fed his turn toward funk in the 1970s. Herbie Hancock has had some personal setbacks, notably a slow slide into a surprise drug problem in the 90s, but not many. He's always come across as engaged and likable, and his book reinforces that impression. I wish he talked about his pianistic influences a little more, but few jazz books are perfect, though Hancock's Possibilities comes closer than some.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Wondering Sound and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed a biography of jazz singer Sheila Jordan, an autobiography of Herbie Hancock, and the 75th anniversary book about Blue Note Records. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Terry recorded recently with actor Josh Brolin, who co-stars in Paul Thomas Anderson's adaptation of Thomas Pynchon's 2009 novel Inherent Vice. It satirizes overcomplicated detective story plots by having an especially overcomplicated plot of its own, so I won't even try to explain the details of the story. Suffice to say, it's set in 1970 in a fictional California beach town where a burned-out hippie private eye squares off with a Los Angeles police detective played by Brolin. Josh Brolin started his film career when he was 17 in the movie The Goonies. He played a gay ATF agent in the comedy Flirting with Disaster. In the film Milk, he portrayed Dan White, the San Francisco supervisor who shot supervisor and gay rights activist Harvey Milk, earning an Oscar nomination. In No Country for Old Men, Brolin was pursued by a demented hitman. In the comedy W, he played George W. Bush. Let's start with the scene from Inherent Vice. Josh Brolin's character, Lieutenant Detective Bigfoot Bjornsson, is investigating a murder and kidnapping case and is hauled to hippie private eye, Doc Sportello, played by Joaquin Phoenix, into the police station for questioning. Doc's bedraggled lawyer arrives and challenges Bigfoot. The lawyer, played by Benicio del Toro, speaks first.
So, what's the beef here exactly?
It doesn't have much to do with your specialty, which I understand is marine law.
We got plenty of crime on the high seas, Lieutenant.
Okay, well, so far we have murder and kidnapping. We can work in pirates if it would make you more comfortable. Either way, it's high profile.
Yeah, but given your history of harassment with my client, this will never make it to trial.
No, I think we could probably take this all the way to trial, but with our luck, you know, the jury pool will be 99% hippie.
Unless you change the venue to maybe like Orange County, not as many hippies down there, you know.
So who are you working for?
Clients pay me for work, Doc. Clients pay me for work, Doc.
That's a scene from Inherent Vice. Josh Brolin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Why did the director, Paul Thomas Anderson, think of you for the part of the detective?
I don't know, because it's
the police detective, not the hippie detective.
Yeah. I never see myself in these kinds of parts, or I at least have some kind of delusion going on where I see myself obviously a little differently than people perceive me. I felt the same way about Milk. I was like, why do they want me to play this? And I start to feel like you have a complex of some sort. But Paul, I knew on the award circuit for No Country, and I've always been a massive fan of his. I was working a lot. I think I just had finished Sin City, and I had the opportunity to do another job, and I'd been working so much, I just wanted to kind of take a vacation and take off, and I was leaving to Costa Rica. And I got a call from him the night before I left, and he said, quote, "I think I may have some work for you. Can we meet?" And I thought that was such a great line. I may have some work for you. And I was so tired, I said the stupidest thing I think I've ever said, and I said, "Can I meet you when we get back?" Which my agent almost killed me about. He said, "Can I send you the script and we read it, and can I come over tomorrow morning?" And I said, yeah, actually, yeah, I've got my head about me again. And I read it, which was absolutely and totally useless. And he came over.
Why was it useless?
Well, it's just, you know, you can't speed read Pynchon. It's just impossible. And his adaptation was so loyal that, you know, it was like reading the book. And it's so dense. Pynchon will go, he'll be following some, you know, linear structure, and then suddenly he'll take a big bong hit and go off on some tangent that still you realize eventually comes around and actually, you know, is connected in various ways. But, you know, when you're reading it, you have to lend yourself to it. And I was trying to read it for me in order to meet Paul before I left on vacation. And then once I went on vacation and was able to read the book and really kind of take it in slowly, as it should be taken in, I saw the validity in me possibly playing it.
So Paul Thomas Anderson is one of the great directors of our time, in my opinion. Is his approach to directing any different from other directors you've worked with?
Only in that it's so familial. You know, I mean, the irony, I think, of working with such great filmmakers is that the collaborative effort seems so much more familial than what I've experienced before. You know, before No Country, I was, not that I'm not now, but just more of a blue-collar actor who was looking for his next job. Whereas now, working with the Coens or working with Paul or Gus Van Sant or people like that, I find the experience so much more familial than anything else I've ever experienced regarding film. You know, there's usually a lot of ego, a lot of pretense, a lot of screaming, a lot of yelling, a lot of putting people in their place, where I don't see that with this. This just seems like creating an ambiance of creative allowance and trusting the filmmaker that he's going to edit it in a way that will be the least embarrassing. In an embarrassing venue. I mean, that's how I've always seen it. You know, it's an embarrassing profession. It's not embarrassing to be in the profession, but the act of doing it is humiliating sometimes.
Why is it humiliating?
Because you're revealing things, and you don't know, you know, given a scene, if you're going to be able to do it. You know, that's always the question as an actor. Can I live up to what this person has written? And there's always a fear around that. I mean, I would love to feel an arrogance in saying, I hope that the writing is as good as I'm going to be right now. But I've never felt it. I don't think I'll ever feel it. There's a nervousness and an embarrassment. And it's not an embarrassment like I'm going to look bad. It's just an embarrassment of, I don't know if I'm good enough to live up to this. You know, and then you see a movie once in a while that you feel like you did your job and that you did justice to the writing or to the, you know, filmmaker's vision, and you're happy. You know, Flirting with Disaster was probably the first film I felt that about.
Oh.
When I saw the film, I said, I'm so happy I'm in this film, and I feel like I didn't ruin at least my side of it.
That's a wonderful film. It's really funny. Let's play a scene from it. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So in Flirting with Disaster, the premise of the movie is that Ben Stiller, who was adopted, wants to find out who his birth parents are. So he gets a woman from an adoption agency, played by Tia Leone, to help him. And he goes on a trip to search for his birth parents. And with him on this trip are his wife, who's played by Patricia Arquette, their baby, and Tia Leone from the adoption agency. And along the way, they meet two ATF agents. One's played by you, and the other by Richard Jenkins. And in one scene, you're all at a restaurant together, and you, the ATF agent, is holding the Ben Stiller, Patricia Arquette baby, and you're so excited about holding a baby in your lap, you're playing with the baby, and in this scene, we learn that you would like to adopt a baby, too, and we learn in this scene that you're gay, and Richard Jenkins is not only your partner on the ATF, he's your life partner, too. So here's the scene. Patricia Arquette speaks first.
Look at him. He loves you. You're wonderful with children.
Oh, I want one of these so badly, I'm telling you.
Mwah. Hey, could you help me out with an adoption, Tina?
Well, that depends on the specifics of your situation.
Well, like what?
Number one, are you married?
Yes.
Number two, does your spouse work?
Yep.
And is she willing to adopt?
Well, you see, that's where the snag is.
Then you've got a real problem.
What would my chances be as a single parent?
Excuse me, please.
Why can't you stay and discuss this?
I believe in privacy,
right.
That's why.
We have nothing to be ashamed of, though.
I don't want to share my personal life with everybody I meet.
It's not just anyone. She works in an adoption agency. I thought that she could be helpful.
God.
You know, I keep telling him that having a baby will reduce stress by taking his mind off work,
but he doesn't listen.
So where did you folks come down on the big circumcision controversy? Because, you know, there's a movement afoot these days to keep the foreskin. And personally, I think a boy's penis should look just like his father's. You know?
Yeah.
That's a fun scene. That's a fun scene. See, that's a great example of once in a while. And I've only seen that. I mean, I saw the movie a few times, obviously, when it first came out, when we were doing screenings of it and all that. But it's a great example of what I may go back to remember how nervous I was during a scene and that it's all going to be okay.
Wait, you were nervous during that scene?
Oh, my God.
Why?
First of all, you have, to me, one of the greatest actors, Richard Jenkins, one of the greatest actors ever. And you have Ben Stiller, who was on a massive upward trajectory. You have Patricia, who I'd known for a while, who I thought was amazing. Tia Leone was amazing. Everybody was amazing. And then this guy. And I remember when I did that movie, Miramax, I'm the only name that's not on the poster because they really didn't want me. I had no value to them. So, and they were really against it at the time. And I remember David really fought for me. And that role, I remember, was written as an Asian. It was an Asian role. And I fought to get in there just because I wanted to do anything. And I didn't care what the race was. I'd play anything. And I was so thankful to get that role because he fought for me. He really fought for me.
This is David O. Russell, the director. So this is an interesting take on colorblind casting, the Asian character as a white man.
Exactly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Josh Brolin, and he's starring in the new Paul Thomas Anderson adaptation of Thomas Pynchon's novel, Inherent Vice. So you grew up with a father who's an actor, James Brolin, who was probably most famous when you were growing up, for his role as the assistant doctor on Marcus Welby, MD, the TV series. Mm-hmm. Did you see him on TV when you were growing up? Did you think of your father as as the guy who's on television?
I didn't. I remember people's reactions to him and how it changed. So I don't remember exactly when he did that show, when he started the show, but I do remember my mom talking about it later, too, about how we'd have no money or we'd be staying in a guest house. And I remember she was saying at some point my crib was a dresser drawer, and they really didn't have any money. They had no money. My dad was just kind of doing what he could do for you know, jobs and money and small work, you know. And then he got that job, and it turned out to be the number one show. So I remember people reacting to him. I don't think I ever saw it until much, much, much later. So I didn't understand what that meant, being an actor, other than we weren't moving as much. We finally got a house, and there were people over.
You mentioned that when you were young, there were times when your crib would be a drawer because your parents had no money. But you eventually were raised on a ranch in California with 65 horses. So at what point did you live on a big ranch?
I was born in Santa Monica. We moved to Paso Robles, I think, when I was 5. And my mother, being from Texas, liked the country. She didn't want to be in the center of Hollywood. She didn't want to raise her kids in the center of Hollywood for whatever reasons. I don't know why. So we grew up on a ranch. We had a 230-acre ranch in Paso Robles. And with the money that my dad made, which I'm sure was much more my mother's decision than my father's, she ran a wildlife way station with the wild animals, and then also...
On your land?
Uh-huh, on our land. So I grew up with a few wolves. I helped birth a lot of mountain lions. We had a lot of bobcats, a lot of scars. We have a lot of scars. And I mean, physical, not emotional.
Yeah, no, I think... So it sounds like you had two really kind of opposite childhoods. You had one growing up on the ranch, but when your parents separated, my understanding is you moved with your mother and ended up in Santa Barbara. Do I have that right?
My parents hadn't separated yet when we went to Santa Barbara.
Oh, okay.
And they separated while we were in Santa Barbara.
Oh, okay.
So I stayed with my mom for a while, and then I moved down with my dad.
While you're in Santa Barbara.
Los Angeles.
While you're in Santa Barbara, in contrast to all the wild animals and the horses and everything, you got involved with a now pretty famous group of people that were known as the Cheeto Rats. Or Cito Rats? Is it Cito or Cheeto? Is it Mendocito or Mendocito?
Cito.
Like Rats.
Montecito,
okay.
Montecito.
Thank
Cito
you.
Rats.
Yeah, so this was a skate, surf, and punk culture. Yes?
Yeah, but it wasn't at that point. It was just a group of guys. It was an interesting time, and I've never seen a group of guys like that ever, except maybe East L.A. You know, when I look at documentaries of East L.A., I go, that's that familial thing, and I don't know if there's any connection whatsoever, but we spent every day together, you know, and there was something wonderfully familial about it.
What did you do when you spent every day together?
Well, we were at the beach. We were at the beach mostly, or we were at gigs. We were at punk gigs.
Did you play?
You know? I did. I played a little. You know, things have gotten confused in interviews and all that, and I said that I was a part of RKL, which was Rich Kids on LSD, which was a big punk band back then, and I was part of the garage band that first started playing, and then they went to be known, you know, with other drummers and other musicians as RKL, and they actually became a fairly well-known punk rock band. It's so funny talking about this. It's so weird.
Once you decided you were interested in acting, was your father helpful to you at all, or were you on such different paths it didn't...
We were just on different paths. I mean, I know he said to me, I think, what his father said to me, and have a backup. I was very interested in law, ironically, criminal law. And that was something that my dad was like, if I were you, I'd get a law degree. But then things happened, you know, and my life took a different direction. And
well, how did that happen? I mean, did you say, I want to audition for a film? Or
I think maybe I asked, like, how would you do that? What do? Do you get an agent? And then I went from agency to agency with a made-up resume. There was nothing on the resume that was true.
What were the lies that you put on it?
Well, it was dumb lies, too. Like, really, really, like, Streetcar Named Desire. Like, movies that I had seen that I knew were plays. And they said, like, who did you play? You know, I played Stanley. How was that? It was wonderful.
Oh, like
you
in know, some local
what
production?
What was the theater? It was the International Theater of Santa Barbara. It doesn't exist. You know? I don't know. And there was one lady, Hillary Shore, who said, okay, I'll take you on, after meeting with many, many, many agents. And she took me on, and I remember I had to get the money to get out of the parking lot because it was Beverly Hills. Then she gave me the money to get out. But I went on auditions, and I was told I was green. I was told I was not very good. I was told I should find a different profession. And I was told some positive things, too. And but the rejection never, it bothered me, but it never stopped me. And then I got really, 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 really lucky. And I got hired to do this film that, you know, these people felt like I was the right person at that moment. And I did this incredible film.
It was produced by Steven Spielberg. Did you feel like now you could get a real buzz from doing actually like legit work and getting paid for it?
Yes, it was legitimate, but it was something, it opened me up to the nerd that I am. And really, all I wanted to, all that extreme behavior, I think, was very, you know, was, like I say, ambient. You know, it never felt entirely comfortable. So when I got to research something and read, and I remember being on the set of The Goonies and like reading Stanislavski books and all that, and coming to Steven and asking him, like, is the tunnel, you know, does it represent like my mother's womb? And what if I started clawing? Well, you know, it was ridiculous. But I don't even say it with embarrassment, because I like that kid. I like the kid that's excited about something. And I was incredibly impassioned. And I wanted to learn so badly. I wanted to really learn how to be the best at this thing that I had never been a part of. So it wasn't really the venue to do that in. But later it was. And then I decided to do theater and all that other stuff.
Josh Brolin co-stars in the new film Inherent Vice. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Saman, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.